with Andrew, Stone Brook, Nine, and here's the Portland Institute, 2 years. Out of here, my program is Danish. So I speak Danish. And he, from what I gathered, was a creative force behind the Pioneer Anomaly, because of the private program, because he, this is the state that I was involved in the Pioneer spacecraft team. So he's been involved in collaboration with John Edison and Starla, Teresa, and others from some of the roots. But Anomaly hasn't gone away, what we can hear about.
Okay, thank you. Should we downstairs like we can use the speed or what?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, well, the title speaks for itself. By the way, you can hear me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the Pioneer Anomaly, the day of its meeting, and a future test that sort of describes the past, the present, and where we hope to go. And I actually must say, it's fun to be here. I'm very glad you invited me. Okay, this is the original Pioneer collaboration. I'll tell you something of the history of how this developed. There were six of us who did this. We started in about 1994, as I will come to in a few minutes. Although the funding data itself had been brewing for like about 20 years. And again, I'll go into the history of how this happened. We wrote, after 4 years, we wrote our sort of discovery paper. Went back to work very hard, more than you ever wanted to know about the Pioneer spacecraft, the anomaly, the errors. I mean, you know, I was raised as a particle theorist, okay? And I know more about spacecraft now than ever wanted to know in my worst dreams. Yeah, I also want to make a sociological question. Usually when we judge people, we judge them by ourselves in our field. You know, a basketball player wants to know how good your jump shot is. That's how we judge whether you're worth something or not. And a theorist tends to judge somebody else by how good they can do intervals. I tend to have a different attitude. I mean, if doing intervals is so hard, how come can I do it? I'm much more impressed by people who can do stuff that I can't do. And I have met in this study a lot of people who are really very, very good at what they do. I am very impressed with the people in the space science business, the people who build craft, the people who navigate them and who study them. And this admiration has grown with time. Mind you, they're crazy. They don't understand things the way I do, which of course is the right way. But they are really good. So that being said, there's John Anderson and Unislav from JPL, Phil Lang and Tony Liu from what amounts to the Aerospace Corporation, Slava also from JPL, and myself. Okay, first we're going to talk about the data. This is a picture of what is what's called Pioneer F at the Cape before launch. They label these crafts by letters until they were successfully launched. Once they were launched, they got a number designation. And in that way, they could keep the numbers going up straight. This is the launch of Pioneer 10 on the 2nd of March, 1972. Meanwhile, this is 1 day after launch at JPL. Do you have a pointer? If not, I can just... Right there, above me here, that's Tony Liu. This is Phil Lang, and in the background is John Anderson. Three of the members of our discovery team. They were there working on the navigation at launch. For those of you who are just out of diapers, I point out the stack of computer cards there. with the last card in the deck. I point out that Tony is looking at a computer output as it comes out. I also point out the Tektronix scopes, which were used. I mean, that's the way you did it in those days.
Oh, there's the haircuts as well.
Yeah, well. Okay, the Pioneer 1011 main missile. These craft are tracked via the Deep Space Network. There are three 70-meter dishes located at just outside Canberra, Australia, just outside Madrid, and in Goldstone in the Mojave Desert in California. That way, the craft is in line of sight of at least one of the antenna 24 hours a day if you want. The trajectories were the following. First, look at Pioneer 10, which is this one right here. It was launched toward Jupiter with the hope that the craft would reach Jupiter. This is the first time any craft went to deep space. There was new navigation, new technology, although from our point of view, very primitive technology, to get it there. They made successfully an encounter with Pioneer, with Jupiter in 1973. Now, this was very unknown. They didn't know if they were going to get to the asteroid belt or not. I mean, they didn't know how dense it was. And they successfully got there, and they found this huge magnetic field, which they were sure was going to burn up their electronics. And it almost blew out the image device, the scanner, which allowed the pictures to be taken. But they turned it off successfully in time. Before Pioneer 10 reached Jupiter, Pioneer 11, they were rich in those days, they could do two at a time, was launched also towards Jupiter. By the time it was partially there, Pioneer 10 had already successfully reached Jupiter. So therefore they could become adventurous. They altered the course so that it would be possible to do a swing by of Jupiter, go back inside across the solar system, meet Saturn on the far side. This is the period in which the grand tours of the planets were thought about. It was during this configuration, about less than 100 years, when you could foresee going through all the planets. And as a matter of fact, they halfway thought of trying to go to Uranus with Pioneer 11. These were the precursors to the Voyagers, which later went on to Uranus and Neptune. Okay, this figure I have not photoshopped out. I just dumped it in right now, so excuse that. Okay, this shows the trajectories of the Pioneers and also the Voyagers. You will note that the two Voyagers and Pioneer 11 are headed in the direction, I'll call it this direction here, and Pioneer 11 is going, excuse me, Pioneer 11 is going here, Pioneer 10 is going there. They are in opposite directions. That turned out to be very important for us, and we'll come to. This is the direction towards the heliopause. What's the heliopause? We are located, our sun is located in the galaxy, and we're going around with a velocity of about 250 kilometers a second around the galaxy. But our local neighborhood has a bunch of clouds. And these clouds and the stars in our neighborhood sort of go relative to each other at speeds of about 10 to 20 kilometers a second. And the local cloud we're in, which is shown up there, is coming at us from this direction. So that means that the magnetic field of the sun is pushed back this way. And right now, it is hoped that the Voyager 1 will see the heliopause before it dies. And if not, future missions may go out there trying to see the real electromagnetic edges of the solar system. Okay, so this stuff was tracked very precisely, and I'll go into why it could be tracked so precisely. Now, it turns out that around 1980, just before, 1970s actually, they were getting to the point where they could track things even better than usual. Why is that? When you're close into the sun, you have a radiation pressure, which is very significant. Now, radiation pressure falls off as one of our arcs squared, just like gravity does, so you would think at first glance it's just a little piece like gravity. No, it's not, because depending upon whether the antenna is pointing this way or that way or that way, there's a different radiation pressure on the craft because different sizes and albedos are reflective surfaces. So you have to try to model the craft to get clear how much of this is due to the 1/r², how much of it is due to the fact it's facing the white antenna dish, how much is due to the fact that it's facing the shielding on the side or on the arms. So that is hard to model. But it gets to the point where at about 5 to 10 AU, this radiation pressure is becoming of the order of what's going to be the pioneer anomaly. So we can clearly distinguish a anomaly from the radiation pressure. That's why that's important. And you look here, they took a number about, they were thinking about 1 year data averages just to make sure they were navigating properly. And, you know, that means everything is being navigated just fine. Hunky dory. Then around this point,
they
did another 1 year after the data. And they got a absolutely huge error bar. But, you know, this is a very small accelerator. But gee, you know, that's still zero. But a year later, they took another one, higher level. And all of a sudden, you'll notice there seems to be, you know, a method to the madness. There seems to be an anomaly. Now, this what had been noticed for like about 10 to 15 years. And nobody, let's say, within the business thought much of it.
The anomaly is the fact that there isn't non-zero acceleration.
Yes. In other words, this is after, what you see here is the acceleration after all the gravity, all of the corona dispersion of the electromagnetic signals, the radiation pressure from the sun, after you take out everything, this is what's left over. Now, 1 second, I'll come to you. By anomaly, I mean the following. What you're measuring is a Doppler shift. Okay? So that's the fundamental signal, and remember that, always. We interpret it as acceleration, but the signal is a Doppler shift, okay? And so you see a Doppler shift, and you take out the velocity, you take out gravity, you take out everything you want. You model it very well, and there's something left over. That's what we're now doing.
Yes. These are one-year averages.
Yeah.
But how often is the acceleration actually measured?
Well, continuously, actually. If you put it this way, depends upon how long you have the, how much time. The data points each come in, let's say, 1,000, most of them are 1,000-second time spans.
Thousands of seconds.
No, 1,000 seconds.
1,000 seconds.
1,000 seconds. Some are 60, some are 120, but most are like about 1,000. Okay? We integrate over them. Okay?
So the fine grained data is one redshift every 1,000 seconds.
Yeah.
And then you're trying to put a find a slope.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is what you're fitting here.
Yeah. Okay.
So as you point out, this is actually the redshift effect. So is the gravitational redshift included?
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah. General relativity is, you know, B squared over C squared.
And how does this compare with the alpha PPN parameter, which is variation from the redshift form? You know, these PPN parameters that qualify the
equations. This is bigger than that.
It's big.
Yeah, I mean this is yeah. Okay, absolutely. Okay.
So how many standard deviations is the last point from zero? It's a lot.
Yeah. Let me say it is a lot, okay? But let me say we're jumping ahead of myself, but okay. But yeah, that is only statistical error.
Oh, systematic error.
Yeah, but this is statistical error. No systematic error has been put in here. Okay? And that's the real question when you're going to come up. How much of it is statistical, is systematic error? To jump ahead again, the statistical error is very small. That's where that 3% came from. Okay? This is something which you have to know about. If you want, you can. Okay? So, anyway, so that's understood there. But, as I was, in 1994, I was prepared to give a talk on gravity and antimatter, which is one of my favorite passions. And I decided to talk about how little we know about gravity actually in the entire universe. By that I mean, to know something, unlike particle physicists, I know QED dates significant figures. Okay, that's knowing something. I don't know gravity dates significant figures except within the solar system. I don't know what in the interstellar medium. I know it's there. I don't know in galaxies. I know it's there, but I can't predict it. Got to put in dark matter, which I call crazy. Okay? We don't know it. So I decided to ask, how far in do we know? And eventually I was led to talk to John Anderson. And I asked him if maybe the Voyager should give you a very precise measurement on this. And for reasons I'll come to later, he said, no, actually you want to do the pioneers, because they're spin-stabilized. And he says, by the way, the biggest systematic in our acceleration residual is a bias of 8 times 10 to the minus 13 kilometers per second squared directed towards the sun. Now that is small. That's about 1/2000 of the acceleration of the sun, of the Earth towards the sun. Okay? Okay, excuse me. You see, that is the acceleration. No, I'm sorry again. This is the acceleration of the Earth towards the sun. Okay? This is about 10 to the minus, what is it? 7? Mm-hmm. Yeah, 7 more, small. This is really small, but you can measure this. That's the whole point. But when I heard that, when I heard him tell me that, I literally almost lost my chair when I read that email. And I, you know, being a particle surgeon, my God, we got to look into this. And I think John's an astronomer, okay? And, you know, astronomers are very careful. And a real astronomer, you know, he can sit down and calculate orbits of asteroids, that sort of stuff. So I think he was probably very happy that you had the crazy part that they were saying, we got to look at this. So we started. And when we started talking to it about people, the first thing was that people said, well, it's got to be a glitch. It'll go away. So, you know, our code works. Now, being from Los Alamos, I know about code. We got codes at Los Alamos, which are for small supernovae. And these codes have been handed down generation to generation and father to son, until the people who run them now don't know what the hell went into them. Okay? They just know they work. So, therefore, if something's wrong, it must be the code. They don't know that one way or the other. It did not go away. You know, we looked. And we said it's small, and things work well enough. Then we really started asserting that the effect was in the data. Well, it must be the code after all. Don't bother us. Go away until you show us it is not the code. At this point, one of the early pioneers, remember this guy, Phil Lang, he was at Aerospace Corporation. He had his own code. So, did the same damn thing with his code. And guess what? It was there. In the data. Not in the code. And in the meantime, an indent down psychology. You see, the problem with that is both of those are West Coast codes. You're not going to believe it until the East Coast finds it, too. That's, you know, the way these things work. Turned out a guy at Goddard went through the data. Found the same thing. It's in the data. Okay? And I can show you. I could spend days on minor things, like, what are these points here? Those are outliers. What's an outlier? How do you measure this stuff? Okay, you go on.
Yeah. Just to wrap that in, so how many completely independently written by independent groups of people?
Three. Two on the West Coast, one on the East Coast.
Any in Europe?
We have collaborated with them. And they're going to join us in what I'm going to talk about later. And what these guys do, they literally count cycles. You know, send the beam, get the responder back, come back and go 1, 2, 3, 4, 2 billion, 111 million, 223, 0, 1, 2, like that. That's what they do. Every second. Periodically they miss one. Now, if you want, you can say, aha, that means there's an error. How do you handle that? You throw it away. Is that fair enough? You could technically say no. It is fair enough. That's how they handle deep space navigation. And that's what those little points are. But you can see, there's the drift. Now, this is very interesting, which I'm not going to go into now, but I just want to tell you it's there. You'll notice that when you do a bunch of points, well, these little lines, those are maneuvers. Every 6 months you have to do a maneuver, even in deep space. Why is that? You want the antenna to be pointing towards the Earth so we can get the signal. Well, the Earth's going around the sun. So 6 months it's here, and 6 months later it's there. So you got to turn. How do you turn with gas jets? So you got to model the effect that has on the acceleration. And so that's what those lines are, maneuvers. You'll notice there appears to be an annual variation in that data. That annual variation is there. We convince it's independent of an anomaly. We think it's something to do with not having the orientation of the orbits right with respect to the ephemerides of the planets. And that's one thing we'll look out in the future. Take my word on that for this point. It's independent of the constancy which is in the background. But it's there, and we're aware of it. Okay, so after we came out with our discovery paper, all sorts of yelling and screaming. It's got to be a systematic. As I was saying to John, if God comes down and asks me to bet my soul, it's a systematic. And that's the way I go at it. I know it is, it's got to be, I've got to be very careful. I don't say it's new physics, I hope so, but you know, you don't operate that way, otherwise you'll make a big mistake. If God gives me $100 to spend at the casino, well, then we'll talk different. Okay? So, but I say that if you say it's systematic, you've got to show me. It works both ways. I'm like St. Thomas the Apostle. You know, until I put my finger in the palm of my hand and decide I will not believe. So show me it's systematic. And so everybody says, well, it's got to be neat. You know, this is our error budget for our giant paper. We went over, like I said, I found out more about spacecraft than I ever wanted to know. And we cannot find any way that it could be heat. Probably is, we couldn't find out how, and nobody else has been able to make a convincing argument. These are the biggest possible systematics that could be caused by. Okay, first is just the concept. Radio beam. You know, we're communicating. 8 watts of power. What's the reaction? Well, the effect is actually 63 watts in the opposite direction, so that actually makes the effect bigger. So this actually makes our effect bigger. But it does change the size of the anomaly. Here's the big one, B. The RTG heat reflection. And coupled with that, the differential RTG emission. Or thermal cooling, or gas leaks. Now, I'll go into details on that now.
What's RTG?
I'm coming to that right now. This is the first craft to go into deep space. Deep space means past Mars. And they realized that you couldn't use thermal panels. Even today's thermal panels. Too far away, 2 weeks, you'd never have the power. So, what could they do? A source of power is heat. Very inefficient heat, but heat. They took pieces of plutonium-238. Not 239, which is the boom kind, but 238. Which has a half-life of 87.74 years, basically alpha decay. You just basically take this stuff. You have to deal with it. You know, plutonium is a very toxic, I mean like poisonous substance. Very difficult to handle. You've got to, in here is a stack of 18, basically, they call them pucks. Little cerments, which are basically a type of alloy. Of molybdenum and plutonium with a surrounding binder. And in each of four different of these units, SNAP-19 RTGs, they put these plutonium pucks. They generated, at launch, 2,500 watts of power with about a 6% efficiency set of thermocouples. And here's what that is. You could generate at launch 165 watts of power. You need about 70 watts to run the craft, and the rest is for the instruments, and it will slowly die off. So that was their solution, and it worked magnificently. And actually, it was lucky also for the Pioneer program, because this is right when the AEC in those days was developing these RTGs. And so just out of development costs, they paid for this, to have this done. So that did not come out of the Pioneer budget. Okay, now this is very hot. And as a matter of fact, contrary to the model, which is like over here, you've seen here, the actual final objects had very large fins, so they could radiate off the heat efficiently. You know, not get the thing so hot it melts. Okay, now, you have this big heat source. And you had alpha decay. And the first time you'd ever been out in deep space, you were afraid it was going to fry the circuit. Remember, this is designed in the mid-1960s. So what do? Get it far away. Put it at the end of booms. That means they had to be spin stabilized. Spin stabilized. Craft are stabilized two ways. In other words, remember my antenna has to point towards the Earth, which is that window over there. And it starts going away, it got to do something. There's one way to do it, which is to have some whole bunch of gas jets, like these little firing things. You start constantly letting off gas jets to keep the antenna towards here. That's the way the Voyagers do it. And that's why they cannot be so precisely navigated. We've checked again with the navigators. The error in their analysis is an order of magnitude bigger than the size of the anomaly. This could be navigated because it was spin stabilized. It's a gyroscope. You don't have to turn it. You just got to turn it because the Earth moves out of the way once every 6 months. And one maneuver every 6 months, you can model it very well. Okay, so for these reasons, it was very, very good. Now, So then the idea goes, well, look at this. What's going to happen is the heat from this thing is going to hit the back of the antenna, radiate backwards, and that's going to cause it. At first sight, you say, my God, that could be it. And it could. But then you start putting in some numbers. It turns out, if you go to the, just do the geometry, go to the RPG, see how much of it actually sees the back side of the antenna. Okay? The amount that sees the back side of the antenna, just from a point, occupies only 1.5 to 1.7. There are three different calculations, two bias, one bias, one bias guy is probably going to do it. What, it occupies only 1.7% of 4pi. So immediately you're down to 40 watts, maximum. And that's assuming all of it gets reflected straight back. Then you put in the fact that this geometry is such that the heat was designed to radiate four-aft symmetric, not towards the craft, but out in this direction. And you end up with the fact that that just can't do it. Maybe it can. Maybe there's conduction down the pipe. We don't know. We haven't been able to figure out how. But this has not been, this a priori does not explain. Next thing that people said was, well, it's got to be the electrical power. This is an interesting idea. When you start a craft, you have 165 watts of power. And that's more than you need to run the craft. So what do? You actually vent the heat out the back. This is a, I'll show you a better picture later. There are some louvers out the back of the craft. I'll give you a better picture later. And these louvers let the excess heat out. And then as it starts getting colder, the louvers close, and you use the power in the instrument bay, excess current is out the side, and furthermore, the electrical power falls off faster than the radioactive power because the thermocouples degrade. And here's the power output with time. By the end of the mission, like you can see over here, this is the end of our data set over here. Okay? There was not enough power to even run the instruments, let alone to cause being on one. And it was still there in constant. So that's not going to be it. Okay. So that being said, yeah?
I mean, you check things like the clock could be just slowing down because the power is decreasing?
There is no clock. It's a transformer. It's a transformer. In other words, the clocks are at home. The clocks are at home.
And you know your clock is stable.
Yeah, so yeah. Okay, well, that was one of our. That was. There's a guy called Bob Bissot, who's at MIT, who did the Tom Ripka experiment in space. And so we had the temerity, so I had the temerity, because gotta check it. That's Bob. If it could be in his clocks. Needless to say, Bob assured me most strongly that it is not in his clocks. And I believe that's a correct statement. So, okay, what do we really know from the big study? This is what we know, okay? For Pioneer 10, between about 40 and 70 AU, there's an experimental number which is like 7.84. Notice the statistical error is very small. For Pioneer 11, between 22 and about 31, there is a similar experimental number off, but within the systematics, as I'll come to say. Okay? Putting both Pioneers together with the systematics of the table I showed you, we get a number of 8.74 plus or minus 1.33 times 10 to the minus 8. Now, to me, being conservative, I don't care how precise the data was. You got to put in the systematics. And that's where my 15% number comes from. That number right there. Okay? That is what I say, there's a constancy of the anomaly, whatever it's called, at that distance of that size. Okay? It is only seen on small 250 kilogram craft on hyperbolic orbits. don't know if that's important or not, but it's a statement of fact. It has not seen a large-bound astronomical body. What I mean by that, is that anomaly applied towards Mars? Its orbit would be different. You could measure that. We laser range to Mars very precisely. Okay? But remember, and this is where the earlier question comes in, about do I know about the frequency of the clocks? This is really a Doppler shift. We're only interpreting it as an acceleration. It could be something funny with time, with this level, or frequency. At this point in time, we can't say. So I want to be very clear, although we think in terms of acceleration, it could be something funny with time.
So just to go back on that, from what I remember, the constraints on this parameter alpha, which is the deviation from the relativistic part, something like 10 to the minus 4, something like that. Is this correct? Is the power of the Snyder experiment?
I believe that is correct. But what I'm more concerned with, the known stability of clocks on Earth. And this, I mean, so that is what we have to worry about. That's what we've got to think about when we do our next analysis.
It's actually Bessel and Levine that set 10 to the minus 4 bound.
Yeah. Yeah.
To my knowledge, that's what stands. They're better than the
power of
this.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the first thing you start saying is, obviously, if it's not systematic on board the craft, then it must be a new manifestation of known physics. So the first thing you think about is, well, not the first thing you think about, but one of the things people think about is, it's got to be due to a drag force. You know, you're going through the interplanetary medium, you've got this antenna, it's dragging against the dust, and that slows it down. Good idea. However, we have measurements, or both measurements and bounds on the amount of interplanetary dust. And when you put that in, the Pioneer anomaly needs much more matter than is actually seen. These are some of the types of limits which exist, and smooth constant density would need that much density to cause the Pioneer anomaly. So if you want to put it this way, the Pioneer anomaly gives you a measured general bound on the interplanetary density. And it's small, but not nearly as small as was actually out there. That can do it. Next thing is, must be a funny distribution of matter within the core crust. Well, my colleague John has long been interested in things like that, going back as far back as talking with Stanley Field back in the early, back in the 1970s. And this is a constant acceleration. What people get fooled by is the fact that if you have a Wannsmeyer density distribution in a spherical density going into the origin, that will cause a constant acceleration. So the first thing is to say that must be the same thing true here. Sorry, it's three dimensions. Go to a two-dimensional disk, and you get all sorts of funny things. It can do it. So have here a bunch of calculations depending upon, you know, constant, one over R, disk, wedge, all kinds of things. No matter what you do, it's not, this is the closest. But then you're going to have these peaks at the end. These peaks at the end of the distribution. It can cause them. What do we only suspect or do not know? And this is where it starts getting very interesting. We have no real idea how far out the anomaly goes. We just have the end of our data. So it's an open question how far out it goes. And theories that want to model the anomaly have freedom out there. We don't know. It continues roughly as a constant out from about 10 AU. We know that. The early data we don't stand behind. Then we have not reanalyzed it yet. I'll come back to that. But we know from about 10 AU out as a constant out to about 7. That's what we know. Before standard encounter, I tell you, and the transition to hyperbolic orbit, Pioneer 11 did not show the anomaly. Pioneer shows an effect only starting at about 10 AU. Is there an onset of the anomaly? Is it being turned on? We don't know. So obviously, this is a question to ask. You can ask, actually, is there a drag corresponding to dark matter? I don't think so, but we want to try to find out. Future test. The first thing we want to do is to go back and look at the early data. We chose the later data for a bunch of reasons. First, we had to demonstrate, remember, that indeed the effect was in the data. The best data was the far-out data, which was clear of the radiation pressure systematics, was modern. People don't believe old data. You ever notice that? Somebody does an experiment 30 years ago and does the same experiment with the same apparatus now, they believe today's numbers. They don't believe it 30 years ago. So this is modern data, you believe it. It's also a modern format, okay? So we could establish with the later data that indeed the anomaly is in the data. But what about if we go back and put it towards the sun? We have undertaken an effort, and my colleague Slava Turchev has led this at JPL, of recovering as much as we can of the old data and transferring it to modern format. I mean, this stuff was on 7 and 9 track tapes. Okay? It was, the raw data was made into orbital data on a VAX with a program called Stripper. You strip out the data you want. Which, it was software to hardware configured. You couldn't use this software in another hardware. And these are old VAXs which are about to be decommissioned. So we managed to hold off the decommissioning of these things until we could get the data we needed. We were able to get all the data back to about 1978. That is good, because that covers the Saturn encounter. So we can take a look to see if there is a turn on the Saturn. We also have some data, some pieces of data earlier, including the 2 Jupiter encounters. So, and we're trying to pick up little pieces here and there. But everything from 78 on, we have. So, what can we find out from this data? First thing, closer in, you get a better idea of what direction it is. Remember, this is delta. So, in principle, it's only line of sight. Okay? Then you transform to barycentric coordinates, you integrate the orbit, you bring it back, you see if it's pointing in the right direction, that sort of stuff. Very complicated, 16 decimal place computation and so forth. So therefore, because of that, the direction is perpendicular to the line of sight are difficult to determine. They become easier to determine closer into the sun. We don't know if we can. We hope we can determine better the direction. If it's towards the sun, obviously it's something new. If it's along the line of sight of the Earth, then probably it's frequency. If it's along the velocity direction, it's something to do with inertia, modified inertia, or drag. If it is along the spin axis, then it's a systematic associated with the crash. So that's one of the things we can look at with the earlier data. We can also look at this actually shows in principle the different type of signals you can get with 1 every 6 months maneuvers. Is it towards the sun gravity, towards the Earth time, along the velocity, drag, or inertia on the spin axis, internal systematics? That's one of the things you want to look at. We also want to look at the time evolution, see if there's indeed a constant or if it varies. These are the flyby systematics, the flyby trajectories. Pioneer 10 became hyperbolic at Jupiter. Pioneer 11 only became hyperbolic at Saturn. It was not hyperbolic before that. Is that important or not? We don't know. We want to try to find out. So, second is the possibility for an add-on experiment. First and most exciting is the New Horizons mission to Pluto. Next slide. Second, we could possibly jettison and back some interstellar probe. Remember I mentioned the way at the beginning the fact that Pioneer 11 and the two Voyagers are heading towards the heliopause? Solar system scientists want to get out to the heliopause. They are foreseeing a mission which they call Interstellar Probe, which will be a fast vehicle, which will head out towards the heliopause, and we would say, hey fellas, can we go along piggyback? You know, we're only cost 100 kilograms. What's that? These new friends. And when we get somewhere out there, you just jettison us. You go on to the stars, and we start spinning and measuring. That's a possibility. We've talked about it, but that crashes way off. But the real thing is New Horizons. Turns out, in the midst of everything else going wrong, there is a mission which is going to be launched in January called the New Horizons mission Pluto-Kuiper. There it is on the panel where it's being put together. This is the artist configuration. This is not our ideal craft. No way on earth is it our ideal craft. The RGTs are off to the side. It's not built symmetric to get rid of heat rating, but it's a craft, and it's going out there, and it's going out there fast. And then I was looking at their website one day, and I noticed that, oh my God, they say that they can operate in both three-axis stabilization or spin stabilization. Furthermore, they were going to possibly swing by Jupiter, I'll come to that in a second, and then go dormant, turn on every now and then to make sure everything's okay on their long cruise. But they got RTGs. There's nothing to keep them from just transmitting data. You know, all you've got to worry about is additional money to keep the Deep Space Network looking at. But that's no trouble to them. So we got in touch with them. Turns out they were new science guys thinking of the same thing. And next month they're having their team meeting, their science meeting, and we're going to go there and give our song and dance and hoopla and all that kind of junk and ask them to do this radio science experiment. Cost them nothing except three-axis stabilization. You know, it's a gyroscope. Once you get it spinning, that's it. Okay? And once you've got, I even argue, you want to keep your radio beam going. Anything turned on or off is dangerous. Turn it on, leave it on. You know, then I got to argue and ask them, can you deep space it? Anyway, might be able to get a rough test. Don't know, but it's worth a try. So we're going to try. Now, the dream. Okay, supposing you're going to make a dedicated mission. How would you do this? Well, the first thing is to do the lessons learned from the pioneers. You want a spin-stabilized craft. You want precise Doppler navigation. And you also want range. Okay, that's a fact. Let's check. We have Doppler. You know, signal goes out, signal comes back. You know the train effect. That's how we lost it. What we would like in addition, and we don't have it for Pioneer, and that's another example of bureaucrats screwing things up. story. We were found on bureaucrats at lunch. There is a guy who at the time was at some power over how Pioneer was going to be configured. And the radio science guy said, well, we should also have range. What is range? Put a phase modulation and you time it. Wait for it to come back. You have a time of flight. That's a check. You can do a better navigation that way. And he said, no, that's just one more thing to go wrong. I grant him that. But if it goes wrong, it goes wrong. and beside that long method. Recently, the same guy was not a big problem from bureaucrat. So, gee, it's really too bad these people didn't have range. Anyway, you want to have the RGBs at the end of long booms, or shielded, and I'll come to that again later. Thermal design with low asymmetry, well-engineered craft and mission. Okay, mission option. Four asymmetric deep spacecraft, formation flying mission, accelerometer. Okay, so we thought of this idea. We wanted to design something that would fit our design. Basically, it's a yo-yo with the louvers on the side. So, you know, the RGBs are off to the side. Even if they do hit the crack, they hit it symmetrically. The louvers come out this way. You don't care about stuff to the side, you just care about thorax. If you wanted to, you could even beam out to space simultaneously. Then if there's any problem with systematics, you could rotate it 180 degrees. Okay, it would broadcast in both directions, so radiation force cancels. So the RG, as I said, the RGGs and the louvers would make the emission of heat, but basically nothing. You could isolate it completely. And then, as I said, you could turn it on 180 degrees if there was any effect to really prove it was not a systematic. With off-the-shelf technology, we could get it, a one-order magnitude less than the size of the normal. And with very high precision stuff, we could do it almost 3 orders of magnitude less than the measuring normal. We could really get the space and time dependent. Then, turns out that while we were yelling and screaming for 8 years, actually 10 years now, some of our European friends were noticing us. And they told us later that they were impressed by the fact that we didn't give up. We just kept on going. And so a group of European Space Agency people had decided to start a new pioneer collaboration. And this is part of the group. It's right now in front of Zarn at the University of Bremen. Here's an idea of what our craft would look like. I mean, this is all artist conception. Real craft was nothing like this, but you gotta make flimsy, color graphics to impress the people who have money that you know what you're doing. There are two things. One, you'll notice it's 4 asymmetric. Now, this corresponds to the RTGs being shielded by what are called Winston cones. That's basically a parabola shield, which is less stated out. Actually, I think I like the Winston cones at the end of a boom. This is only preliminary design. So what I would have, you have the Winston cones, but you shoot the whole thing out and boom. Here are the louvers. Then, in addition, you would have a corner cube laser ball. And out of the bottom end of the craft, you would laser range to a free form corner cube. So you would get to the pioneer anomaly on the mother craft, let's say to of the order of maybe 10 to 20% of the anomaly, and you would do it a factor of 2 to 4 better doing the laser cube. Okay? So you have 2 experiments. And you say, well, why do you want to do it that complicated way? Because it's the real world. This is an expensive experiment. The people who have money are the technology people. If they can do new technology, they'll happily do your science. But if they don't have any new technology to wave, they're not interested. The new technology here is the beginning of formation flying, which is going to be very important in LISA, SET, and other possible deep space missions, but has not been done yet. This would be a first step in that direction. In addition, there's also the question, do you want to put drag stage accelerometers inside the craft? Again, politics. The Germans want formation blind. The French want accelerometer. I want the experiment. As far as I'm concerned, man, you can have anything you want. You know, but that's their politics. And so maybe in the end, if you get the French and the Germans on board, if this mission flies, you'll have, you know, everybody's experiment. I said, I don't care. Whatever works. Okay, you could get it down to, I say, to 0.1 times 10 to the minus 8 or less. That's 1% experiment, basically. You know, just, you know, that's about a 1% experiment, 2% experiment, actually. Determine the physical origin of any anomaly is found. Standard spacecraft bus, symmetric four axis as much as possible, louvers on the sides, power at launch about 200 watts, probably RTGs. I want them 3 meters from the rotational axis of the spacecraft or shielded, maybe. I would want them both. The mass is about 300 kilograms. Dimensions at launch, it's got to fit inside the standard fairing of a big spacecraft. Attitude control, absolutely spin stabilized. Navigation with Doppler range and possibly VLBIN or Delta DOR, you know, long range based stuff or changing the Doppler. Pointing control, about 6 microradians. Microwatt laser to the probe, that means you don't have to worry about direct reaction on the probe itself. Lifetime, 7 years, a nominal for velocity of 5 AU a year. 12 years if you could get it extended if you found something. The orbit, solar system escape trajectory, possibly in the plane of the ecliptic, coming with the solar system direction within the local medium, interstellar medium. Spacecraft moving with a velocity of 15 AU or a year more, reaching 15 AU in 3 years' time or less. That's important. That's more than twice the speed of the Pioneers, or even close to that for the Voyagers. Why is that? I want to still be alive when the data comes in. I'm funny that way. Slava, he can wait. Okay. So, what do you need? You need a big launch. Ariane 5 or Proton for any heavy duty Delta 4, etc. There's the, on the left you see the French Ariane spacecraft. On the right is something that's close to my heart, the Russian Proton rocket. That is a workhorse. It's been there for years. It is, how do I put it? It's the height of Russian engineering. It is simple. It's basically a can with a fuse off the end. You like fuse. But it works! It's very, very, you know, stable, and it just works continuously. The Ariane every so often goes, boom! But that one works. I love it. As stated, a test could be either a standalone mission or a probe of a larger mission. Such a mission will not make me determine the validity of the Pioneer now. And by determining the validity, I mean even by now that it's systematic. Look, if it's systematic, so be it. But damn it, I want to find out what it is. It would also advance the metrology of deep space. One of the things that our collaboration has done is that it's made other people look at small effects like this in a much more precise method than they have before. We have had impacts, we know from conversation, on, for instance, the LISI experiment. Can we even point out, have you guys worried about that? You know, this is really big. Gee, I guess you've already got to worry about that sort of stuff. People knew this in principle. We aren't saying anything that nobody didn't know. But we're saying it with point of example. You know, here we can see the effect, you've got to worry about. So therefore, any deep space mission in the future which wants precise navigation, like they want to get out to that newly discovered planet, 10th planet, it's going to need technology which is useful for precise navigation. And that's what we may have given them. At the very least, it was a systematic, that's what we have given to the space community. But if the anomaly exists, if it's in physics, well, then I'll hand it off to various people who have their own ideas of what it might be. The Mon people, John. I follow this stuff very closely and I talk with them. But I religiously don't join any camp. Again, for the same reason. To do this experiment, and after 10 years to get it believed, we had to be very, very careful. We had to very carefully say what we know, what we think, and what we suspect. And not to confuse them. Because people are waiting there for you to trip and then shoot you while you're down. That's the way it is. So we encourage everybody's ideas as much as possible. But again, like St. Thomas, I want to see it. And so we're at the point now where many people are seriously thinking of ideas that can explain this anomaly. And hopefully in 1 year, we will have the older data analyzed. And at that point, I think we're at the point where we can say, yeah, guys, you've got to really think of something new now. Or else, sorry, it's systematic. But that's a 1 year time scale now. And after a decade, that sounds pretty close. So, that's where Pioneer 10 is headed. Elder Baron, the big red giant in the right hand corner. It's very funny. When this craft was launched, Frank Drake and Carl Sagan, thinking very visionary, the early SETI people, extraterrestrial intelligence, they put this plaque on the Pioneer so that anybody finds it, they can know where we are, and who we are, and what we're about. And I've always thought, I'm not sure that was a wise idea. And I have it here, actually, I'm not going to show it now, if you want to see it, you can. The clip from Star Trek V, where the Klingons discover Pioneer 10. So anyway, with that closed, thank you very much. Welcome.
Yeah, you talked a lot about the anomaly in Pioneer 10, specifically in Pioneer 11 as well. Is it the same magnitude of acceleration?
Yeah, same magnitude. It's
That's
and they're going in opposite directions. That's the point.
Right, and they're about the same.
Yeah.
And other spacecraft like Voyager.
The error in the navigation. See, that's the point. This signal is so small, you have to have very precisely navigated a quiet craft. Okay? No. I even checked last year again with the latest data from the Voyager. Okay? And I wrote back to the guy who was doing the radio science for this, for the Voyager. And I said, I heard that previously the error in your navigation is an order of magnitude bigger than the anomaly. And he said, yep, that's still true. We can't do any better with the Voyagers. This is really very precise to navigate. That's the whole point. Let me put it this way. These things are going, what is it, 2.5 AU a year. That's like about 12 kilometers a second. And I'm measuring an acceleration of 8 angstroms per second squared. That is really small. Over 30 years, it adds up, but at any particular small time, it's very little.
I just wondered, in the most optimistic scenario, when could we learn either the confirmation or refutation?
1 year. Yeah.
Firmly?
Like No. You asked me for the most optimistic.
No, but I mean, affirm in the most optimistic, would such a refutation or confirmation
yes.
be firm?
Yeah.
Right. And so it could be as soon as a year.
Could be as soon as a year.
And but worst case scenario?
Worst case scenario?
Well, never, obviously. But
No. Obviously, you'll find it out sometime. But put it this way, past my lifetime is the worst case scenario.
Well, for you.
But not yours. You're younger. Certainly, I would think, but your lifetime would be the other one. Okay? But actually, I don't care as much after that.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Yeah, what about this? Sometimes things are quoted about.
Yeah. Yeah, we try. Ulysses, we did Ulysses, okay? And it seemed to show an anomaly, that part of its orbit, okay? But unfortunately, it had a failed mutation network. By that I mean, you know, remember there's just little strains, and so the gyroscope starts moving. So therefore you gotta damp out the mutation. It's very simple. I basically have a ball inside of a gas tube, and that bounces back and forth, and the friction with the gas damps the mutation. Very primitive, works very, very well. It failed. So that means from Jupiter to solar conjunction, there had to be 287 new moons. And I told you how hard it is to model moon. To the eternal credit of Phil Lang, one of the team, who is in charge of the Chasm code, the second code, he modeled all 287 of those moons. And he lined his corner. Okay? And he said, yeah, I see the anomaly, but you know what? Individual errors are an order of magnitude bigger than the size of the effect. So here's zero, here's the anomaly, here's the errors. Couldn't do it. You know, we say it's indicative, but that's all. Couldn't say anything wrong.
Sure.
You said that the effect is not seen on big things like planets.
Yeah.
And then
by that I mean if this was a
constant acceleration.
Yeah, if this was a gravitational type acceleration, it would be seen, for instance, the position of Mars with respect to the Earth.
Yeah, but we don't start seeing these in Mars. So where exactly, with respect to the planets, do we start seeing the anomaly?
We don't.
It's beyond.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is it before Uranus and Neptune?
Depends on what theory you're using to model. We just say right now we do not see the effect in the planets.
No, the question is, on the Pioneer, is at what distance with respect to the planet?
Oh, Saturn.
Saturn. Yeah. So is this a statement about the effect is not seen on the planets? Do you have accuracy enough for Neptune, say, for the Uranus?
It's about that point now for Uranus and Neptune. Okay? There was an article, if you had a constant without any variation, then I believe it also would not be seen there. Okay?
Exactly enough. We know enough about the planet
and
the
outer planet. Planet Pluto, we don't.
Yeah.
Okay. And Uranus, it's a little bit close.
Because that is the most shocking thing. You have two things in the same place, and one is big, one is small, and they have different dynamics.
The point is that Pluto has only gone a third of the way from its orbit.
Sorry?
If the anomaly is gravity, okay, let's say it's gravity, then it's something new. There's got to be something new.
You think the mass, the test mass, not.
Yeah, right. I know we have a test mass, okay, and it doesn't follow normal Newtonian gravity, at least in the inner part of the solar system, okay. So therefore, it's got to be something new in gravity. I mean, that's a given, okay? If you assume it's gravity. We're not making that assumption. We're saying we see it in the data. That's all we're
saying. So, I mean, in any case, if it's not gravity, it's some long-range force.
Well,
some
no,
range.
But if it's not gravity, we didn't modify the last thing. If by gravity, I mean GR, okay? It is not GR.
Yeah, but if there is an alternative, it has to be some long-range force which somehow works at some intermediate scale, like some 50, sorry.
Yeah, right.
Or
yeah,
AU
which,
or something.
Which is not in general relativity. That's what I'm saying. In other words, it could be gravity, but it's not general relativity.
Hello,
Adrian. Well, actually, I have two questions. One is, are there proposals where something like this could affect an object that's small in mass and it does not affect your objects? I mean,
there are proposals, and you have to go to the seminar, where it will affect, it will be distance dependent. Okay, in a way that you would still be in agreement with the current data on the
And the second question is, you say basically what you observe is a Doppler effect.
Yeah.
If you put it in terms of times, how big are these times that the anomaly corresponds?
Corresponds on the order of a quarter of a cycle over about 10 years.
Quarter of a cycle of what? I mean, seconds.
Yeah, right. Well, you got a two gigahertz signal.
Yeah.
Excuse me, megahertz. Okay. Okay. And your cycle comes off by about a quarter in 10 years.
Oh, I see. It's terribly small.
Yeah. Very small.
I just wanted to tie down the thing that Joe was asking about the planets, because I heard two different things. So let me ask you separately.
Okay.
I hear a claim about the inner planets, that we know the orbits of the inner planets precisely enough to rule out a constant acceleration of the magnitude of the sun.
By inner planets, I mean, no, I mean two statements. Let me give you the precise statements. The precise statements are the distance between Mars and the Earth would be very different. By that I mean kilometers different than what it is. Because you know it very precisely from laser imaging. Okay?
Over what time period?
No, well, just its orbits, just the orbits. Okay? I mean, you just think, you know, what's the radii of the orbits that corresponds to the frequency of the period?
Okay, but if it's an effect that turns on somewhere around the orbit of Saturn.
Yeah.
Okay. What I heard John saying is that we don't have good enough data for the outer planets to rule out the outer planets being subject to this.
Okay. There's some, I won't say controversy, but unsettlement in that point. Okay. One of the big problems is we only know those. We don't have anything standing there. Okay. In other words, we don't have no active signal. We just have flybys here on the planets, and that is lost. Okay, now what you need is something orbiting the damn thing. Then you could tie it down very precisely. Okay, so there's a paper out which infers that it won't work for the outer planets. I have not done that calculation or checked it, okay? So the statement is a paper which claims it's ruled out by the outer planets, but it's not clear that it's correct. Okay, either way, is of interest to me, but I just have to not check it. That's fine.
But related to that, if the effect turns on around Saturn, mm-hmm. would it be possible to use the orbits of the moons of Saturn to look at it? I mean, I realize this would require complex modeling, but on the other hand, you've got lots of moons,
so
you might hold statistics with.
Well, no, because they're being subject to Saturn mass.
Well, you'd have to maybe use Saturn's mass. I know, it's a complex model, still. It's
well, I mean, you could do that depending on what the model is, okay? For instance, what if it, you see, what if it, this gives you an example, what if it's a drag force? Well, then the moons are just huge. They won't make any difference at all. A small mass spacecraft will make a difference. Okay, so it depends upon what the model is. Okay, and I admit, if you'll notice, in our proposed tests and everything, we're trying to make this as general as possible. We're not pushing any, we're trying to think of all possibilities and test as many of them as we can. I mean, if somebody comes along with one of the tests of the specific model, great. So,
what about velocity dependence? How does the velocity say comparative velocities of inner planets?
Well, velocity dependence, that's one of the other reasons why we want the new spacecraft to go to a different velocity. just as fast.
Right.
Okay? I mean, that's the scientific reason. The real reason is I want to be alive. Okay?
But I wanted to know how the velocity of the fine nearest, say, compares to the velocity of the velocity of Mars.
Oh, well, remember, it's an escape orbit. Okay, it's an escape orbit, but it's an escape orbit at Jupiter or Saturn.
Right.
Okay? So right now it is, what is it? Okay, the Earth is, what is it? The Earth is, what is the orbital velocity from 30, is it?
30.
Yeah, okay, 30 kilometers a second. The escape velocity of the Pioneers is like about 12. And what is it, about 8 to the 4/3 of that? Something like that. So it's of the order of, it's of the order of probably Mars, okay? But less than Jupiter, because it's factor of square root of 2 over Jupiter more. It's at least that, because it escaped from Jupiter.
There are neurological questions. So where did you take you compare this acceleration, you know, divided by the velocity square and the time scale and the length scale? Is it comparable to?
It is
to
the Hubble constant.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's Hubble constant units of C. And by the way,
okay.
I did not say that.
Okay.
In other words, I refuse to say that publicly. But you want to know the truth, this level comes in the one way.
So you get the velocity of the spacecraft, and that you get
acceleration.
Yeah, acceleration compared to the velocity of the spacecraft.
No.
Because
the acceleration, we only have one number, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The acceleration and velocity of the spacecraft. Okay? But one thing which is true is that the Pioneer anomaly is equal to the Hubble constant in units of C to within 20%. You know, a lot of people ignore that. And we noted it in our paper because other people wrote it. I'm not going to go there.
Well, it is non well, it's the same as the Mond acceleration.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, of course. No, Mond is off by a factor of 8, but we're there.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Okay, yeah, right. That'll be the same, okay? For what it's worth.
No, if you want, it is a cosmic acceleration.
On the solar system, it's going to get right, but they're probable with that if I want. I love it, I don't believe it. Yeah. Yep.
What's the acceleration of the Sun and the galaxy going around the galaxy?
That's a good question.
Right, so I'm wondering, so is it possible that what you're seeing is that the Sun or the Earth or something is falling with the galaxy, with the Sun going around the galaxy? And
no, because it goes towards the Sun.
But,
I mean, it could be an inertial force.
Yeah.
It could be an inertial force, but it points towards the Sun
in two directions.
Yeah. See,
here's the Sun. So that won't explain it.
Yeah.
But it's also the same order of magnitude.
Yeah.
Well, what is the data you receive from those spacecrafts every time it's in something?
Well, okay, what happened? Okay. You're at Goldstone, California. You get your clocks going, you get your antenna pointing the right direction, and you send out a signal. 8 hours later, it reaches the Pioneers. Pioneers have a transponder, which sends it back at 241 over 220 times the signal, because you don't want any signals interference. Comes roaring back. In the meantime, without having to turn around, you're at Canberra. So Canberra receives the signal back. Now it has its clocks, and they're synchronizing the clocks in Goldstone, and the data is transmitted to Goldstone. Then it gets sent to JPL. JPL takes this raw data. Oh, by the way, there's a comparison of the clocks are going wrong. And then you've got to put in all sorts of shit. Sorry, but it's shit. Okay, the antenna was at this angle, so that means it sagged that much. It's daytime, which means the ground of the antenna station went up this much. The tides are coming in, so it actually went down this much. Furthermore, we know there is a storm in the troposphere, so we take care of that. There is a solar wind coming through. We worry about that. We know the positions of the planets, so we put all that in. Take that all out. That's a thing. Very complicated. I'd be lying to my teeth if I said I could sit down and do it. Okay? But they can't. They're very good.
So things that you can measure is the time duration, the signal?
No. Thing you measure is the frequency.
Okay, and measure the amplitude.
Yeah.
Why is it difficult to measure the direction of the anomaly? What are the factors?
Well, the first thing is all you have is the line of sight. Okay? So from that and where it is, like, you know, it was here and now it's there. So you're going to figure that, okay, it's in this direction, it went that way. What is the way that I could have a craft that I know have these initial conditions and gets over here to this point? So I'm pointing in that direction and it's there. Not here, not there, not there, not there, but there. So you integrate the orbit back and forth, you get convergence. Okay, and it's difficult to do that in three directions. At this level, okay, at a much smaller level, at a much higher level, you can do it. But at this level, you can't. It's difficult.
I'm surprised you blame the atomic clocks for being a bottleneck, because I thought you could get.
I didn't blame
you. Didn't.
I didn't. No, no.
So the thing on Earth is fine, probably.
No, but the point is, you got to be careful.
I thought you had a stability for about 10^-15 a year.
Yeah. Yeah, you do, okay? But you damn well want to make sure the clocks are working right.
Right. So what clock is it being used?
Well, they just installed new clocks, and I really am not up to date on what the current ones are. But the ones for the pioneers were built by Father Sol in Latin.
It's just like some transition.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, major clocks, yeah.
So one comment on this, the effect of this anomaly is only on small bodies and not on the planets. Mm-hmm. You see, there's a difference between the way the planets move on this filter move. The filter moves outside, goes out to the solar system. The velocity is directed radially from the sun, mm-hmm. while the planets are vertical. So that fits in the anomaly is some difference in the direction of this velocity. So we won't assume, it's only on the vertical radial direction, not on the on the planets and the.
If it's a velocity dependent thing, that's why we always emphasize why in the test of the anomaly we want a hyperbolic if we're going to test it.
See, in that case, is it really useful to study the Pluto effect of the other Pluto? Yes, the Pluto is kind of elliptic.
I claim no, because Pluto is known very well. It's known very imprecisely, much better than you have the Pluto Express. Actually, we're going to find out where it is.
I'm not talking about Pluto exclusion, I'm talking about the orbit of Pluto.
I know, but we don't know where it's at. That's what I'm saying. We're actually going to find out when we get there. I mean, you know, we're going to be heading, whoops, sorry, got to go this way. That's what's going to happen. We don't know what position very well.
Yeah, just to be very conservative, assuming general relativity is good in the solar system, okay. So on and so forth. It really depends on whether Neptune and Uranus, supposing they allow this size of anomaly, could be sort of some undetected dust around Saturn, in between Saturn and Neptune or wherever, which turns on the next one. So
the only way.
Would that be consistent?
The answer.
I've got a straight answer about Neptune and Uranus.
Okay, but you will get an answer about the dust, because that I know. That is excluded from actual measurements. The amount of stuff you need is much less than you actually see. Okay? You mean gravity?
You mean much more.
No, to cause the anomaly, it's much more than is there. It can.
How do we know?
How
would you see it?
Okay, infrared measurements. You send craft, these were done on a deep spacecraft. You have infrared measurements you take of stars. And so therefore, by the attenuation, you know how much stuff is between you and them.
That includes all sizes of dust?
That includes basically a distribution of stuff, yeah.
I still don't know whether Neptune and Uranus are allowed.
Well, maybe I should then sit down.
That's a key question. It's looking for us.
Yeah, okay. I will sit down and look at it, okay? That's a promise.
Okay. My idea is tomorrow. I can see. Thank you tomorrow. Sorry. Anyone has any more questions about it? Actually, the subject. And I think we should thank you for the informative and like the talk. Sure. So if the room just below us is like that, I'd love to get a coffee to take some away.
I'll take it. Pioneer 11 in Flight of the Long Day is 17 degrees. Yeah. Starting from Saturday. That was the case. So was, but roughly on the plane,
yeah.
Go
ahead.
You need to look for that.
Yeah, so we should leave here about 6.
Yeah,
I don't think
so.
Do you have a cell phone?
Yes.
Do you have a cell phone?